This is Science Friday. I'm Anoush Zomorodi, host of WNYC's Note to Self podcast, sitting in for Ira Flatto. It was late October when residents of Porter Ranch, California, first noticed the smell of rotten eggs. It turned out natural gas fields in nearby Aliso Canyon had sprung a massive leak, spewing about 100,000 pounds of methane into the air each hour. California has declared a state of emergency, thousands of people have relocated, and some have called this the worst environmental disaster since the BP oil spill. But the Southern California Gas Company now says it will take until February, if not March, before the leak can be plugged. And so why is it taking so long? Rob Jackson is an environmental scientist at Stanford, and he's been monitoring the situation in Aliso. Are you in California, listener? How has the methane leak affected you? You can call us at 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK, or tweet us at SciFry. Rob, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Manoush.
So can you explain to us, what exactly is this natural gas storage field?
Well, the Aliso Canyon storage field is one of about 420 places around the country where companies pump natural gas underground to store it. It provides a stable supply, but they also do it to speculate on the price. They can pump gas underground in summer when natural gas prices are low, and then pump it back out in winter when people are using it to heat their homes and the price is higher.
So why how did they figure out that they could do this? How long have we been doing this for, and where does that space underground come from?
Oh, we've been doing this for 50 years or more than 50 years. Most of the gas storage fields are old oil and gas fields. Imagine pumping the oil and gas out over decades. You have lots of open pore space available underground. And because the field stored natural gas for millions of years, when you put it back underground, the chances are it will stay there unless you have an accident with the well itself, which is what's happened here.
Yeah, we'll get to that one, right? But so physically, I'm sort of imagining caves, but that can't be right.
No, it's not really like a cave, say, in Carlsbad Caverns that listeners might have walked through. It might be more like a honeycomb, as a better analogy. There are cracks and pore space. It's just not something you could walk through or swim through or anything. But there's just lots of open space available underground.
And how do we actually get the gas out then? How do we pump it?
Well, in these storage fields, the Aliso Canyon field was an oil field that has about 115 old wells on it that are used today for storage. So what used to be a well that was used to pump oil out of the ground is now a well that's used to pump natural gas back down into the ground and then back out of the ground when it's extracted.
And is that where the problem could be then, the pipes and cement that get the actual gas out?
That is where the problem is. There's a particular well at this location that began to have a problem at least as early as October, and the company made efforts to use mud and brines, and imagine pushing heavy fluids down that well to try and counterbalance the pressure of the gas that first started coming out. And they tried all of that, and it failed, and eventually the gas started bubbling down and out around the cement sheath and through the rocks up into the air. And at this point, it's an uncontrolled release of natural gas that's just belching natural gas about 2.5 million pounds of methane every day.
And you've been driving around there, right? Tell me what you've seen and how you're going about monitoring these natural gas concentrations.
Well, we've been driving. There are lots of other folks that are taking measurements in the area because it's so important. So when we drive, what we see is, first of all, we're using a laser, a Picaro laser that gives you an instantaneous reading of the methane concentration. And imagine putting that laser in a car where you have a sampling port out front, and you drive fairly slowly, block by block, and sense the concentration of methane in the air. So what we're finding is that in parts of Porter Ranch, we don't see any increase in natural gas concentrations at all. But when the wind is in the right direction, and that's key, and when you're in the upper part of Porter Ranch near the gas field, then we start to see really high concentrations of methane. Now, they're not so high that they're a health risk to people. The health concern really is what other trace gases might be in the air, such as benzene, which is a carcinogen, or hydrogen sulfide, which is poisonous.
And so the people who are complaining of dizziness or nosebleeds or headaches, what could be causing that?
That's probably being caused by the mercaptans. The mercaptans are sulfur compounds that companies put into natural gas to give it an odor. Methane doesn't have a smell. And we began doing this in the U.S. in the 1930s when a school in Texas blew up, killing several hundred people. And after that point in time, everybody started putting these odorants in the gas, and those odorants can be irritating. They can cause breathing issues, runny eyes, nosebleeds, and things like that. We're very, very sensitive to mercaptans. That's why they're used.
Okay, so let's take a call. I think we've got Ken from Mayville, Wisconsin, on the line. Hi, Ken. It's Manoush here, Science Friday.
Hi. I actually grew up in Aliso Canyon, right there. My parents still live in the house I grew up on. It's the last row houses before you go up into that gas field. It's not the first time anything like this has happened. Back in the 70s when we first moved there, I believe it was like 73, 74, one of the wells actually blew up. And they had rented air, came in, it burned for about a month or so. Huh. It blew out at one time from the Santa Ana winds, and they had to relight it because they were afraid the whole Santa Ana Valley would blow up from the sinking gas into the valley.
And so what would you do then? Would you sort of leave the area for a while?
Well, when that well blew up and it was burning, it was ignited gas, so it was burning off. But right now, from what I get from my parents, is most of the neighbors have moved out of the neighborhood, and they don't really smell it or have much effect from it. It is been a big concern with everybody in the neighborhood.
Well, thank you so much for calling. So, Rob, let's talk about what's been tried so far to plug the leak.
Well, first of all, the caller's right. We'll get to that, Manoush, really quickly. I mean, there were two oil well blowouts, one in 1968 and one in 1975. In terms of what's been done, as I mentioned, the first thing that a company might typically try and do is to provide back pressure. So when you have a blowout or the possibility of a blowout, you have pressure in the gas or the liquid that's percolating up to the surface. So one way you can counterbalance that is to push back down on it. Hmm. And the way companies push back down on it is to use things that are dense, such as clays, or you take water and put a lot of salts and turn it into a brine, like a very, very heavy seawater. So you push these back down. And this was tried multiple times at Aliso Canyon, and it just didn't work. And then they started having trouble with freezing underground and lots of interactions that began to force the gas out and then into the rock and up, and also began to destabilize the well itself. So the only way this could get worse would be for the well itself to just rupture at the surface and have the leak actually come right up the steel tube into the atmosphere. And that's not happening right now.
So when the caller says that this has happened before, can you put it in context how this current situation compares in terms of how damaging it could possibly be to the environment?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite different. What happened before was a blowout in an individual oil well, a much smaller scale. It doesn't mean that those individual blowouts can't be dangerous, and it doesn't mean that people can't be hurt from them. But on a scale of actual emissions, of the size of the leak, this is dwarfing anything that's happened like that before in this area, or really almost in any other area in this country. This is very unique and very unusual.
And just to put it into context, like how big is it, I guess, is the question.
Well, the leak, as I think I mentioned before, is about 2.5 million pounds of natural gas every day.
What can you compare that to? Like, for me, that, I gotta say, that doesn't mean much. To explain.
Yeah, here I'm. Yeah, I know I'm a scientist. I'm sorry. I'm struggling. I'll hold that thought, and I'll see
okay,
if I can come up
right.
with
That's
a
fair
better
enough.
Analogy. I mean, you can think of maybe just in terms of the leak itself. Sometimes I use the analogy of a balloon, and you can think of these underground storage fields as a balloon underground that's they just keep pumping gas into. It gets very, very high pressure, and if the knot on that balloon comes untied, then the gas jets out, and it takes a long time for that air to finish. It just keeps jetting out, and that's what's happening at Aliso Canyon.
Let's take one more call. We've got a question from, I believe, Samuel in New York City. Hi, Samuel. You're on Science Friday.
Hi there. Well, one of the questions that I had was, what do you think would, how would it affect the water table? Because I know over here in New York and in upstate New York, they're really concerned about fracking and how that would affect the public water table. How do you think this natural gas bill in itself would affect it, and what are they doing to fix it?
I don't think it's likely that this leak will have a big effect on the water table. It is possible. The leak is about, or the breach appears to be about 500 feet underground, less than 1,000 feet. It's also up on a mountain or a couple, 1,000, 1,200 feet above the surface. So is it possible that there could be water interactions? I guess it is. It's not something that I think is likely, and it's not something, honestly, that I've looked at or know that much about.
Samuel, thanks so much for your call. And in terms of the greenhouse gases, then, is that the real fear here in terms of the long-term effects, Rob?
I think there are three issues that people are concerned about. The greenhouse gas budget is one. And, you asked me for some context on what 2.5 million pounds a day is. Well, one way to place it in context is to look at California as a state. And this leak is bigger than the methane that's emitted by all industrial activities in California, including the entire oil and gas industry.
Well,
so
okay, that
else,
puts it in context.
Everything in the state that's going on, it's huge.
Yeah.
So that's one concern. In terms of the global methane budget, it's not huge. You're not going to see a massive spike in the atmosphere because of this leak. It's huge, but it's not that huge. The second issue that's probably also not a huge concern is the interaction with ozone. Los Angeles, in its air, has a problem with ozone. The ozone in Los Angeles is catalyzed by hydrocarbons rather than nitrogen oxides, but it's not typically catalyzed by light hydrocarbons such as methane and ethane, and it's also winter and it's rainy, so that would only likely be an issue if this went into the summer, and even then it might not be. But the biggest issue and the thing that people are most concerned about are the trace gases. What else is in that air at low concentrations that could cause health effects long term?
Rob, we have to leave it there. I can't thank you enough for explaining this to us. Rob Jackson is an environmental scientist at Stanford. Coming up, we'll talk grifters and con men. It's the psychology of the con. This is Science Friday. I'm Anoush Zomorodi, sitting in for Ira Flatow. An unusual newspaper ad surfaced around 1900. Its author was one Prince Bill Morrison, a nobleman from Nigeria. And Prince Bill had just one humble request for newspaper readers. Could he find a few American pen pals? Turns out he could. Letters streamed in. And it was only then that Prince Bill made his second humble request. Could his new friends send along a few bucks and an old pair of pants? In return, Prince Bill promised ivory, diamonds, and emeralds, riches that never seemed to materialize. And so was born the Nigerian Prince scam, the very same scam that could be sitting in your spam folder right now, more than 100 years later. What makes some cons so successful year after year? And why, oh why, do we fall for con artists like Prince Bill? Well, according to my next guest, the answer has to do with some very basic features of human psychology. Maria Konnikova is a psychology PhD and contributing writer for The New Yorker. Her new book is The Confidence Game, Why We Fall For It Every Time. She joins me here in the Science Friday studio. Maria, so good to see you.
It's wonderful to see you, too.
Okay, so who was Prince Bill, really?
A Nigerian prince, of course.
I actually know a Nigerian prince, which makes it so funny.
He was a 14-year-old American boy.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, absolutely, who was doing this from just good old US of A and who managed to get a lot of money and, one would suppose, a lot of pants as a result of this approach.
But you use him as sort of an example of the classic foot-in-the-door technique.
Absolutely. So he was a master of one persuasive tactic, and that's what happens when someone does something very small for you, like write you a letter, become your pen pal, become your friend because you're a very lonely young boy. Well, actually, not young boy, I'm sorry. A very
Nigerian
noble,
prince.
Yes, noble prince.
But lonely as well.
But lonely. And so you get your foot in the door that way. You ask for something quite small, something quite manageable, something even, kind of heartening,
yes,
and wonderful.
That makes me feel good that I responded.
Absolutely. It makes you feel like a really good person. And then once you have your foot in the door, it's there for the asking. You can ask for anything because now the person will think of themselves, first of all, as a nice person. You're already very generous because you've already given me your time. You've given me these small things. And secondly, you want to be consistent towards Bill in particular, because if you've already invested all this time and energy with him, well, that means that he's worth it. So we rationalize that if he's worth it now, he's worth it for future favors. And so then you ratchet it up. You ask for $4. You ask for a pair of pants. Huh. If he was able to keep this going, which unfortunately this scam doesn't really lend itself to that, but he could have next time asked for something else, just because we like to keep helping the people we've already helped. That sort of internal consistency is something that we really value.
So let's go back for a minute. You talk about all kinds of things in your pieces that you write for The New Yorker, but why did you decide writing a big book about cons? Like, what got you thinking, I have a lot to say about this?
Well, the prosaic answer is I was watching a David Mamet film. Uh-huh. I was watching House of Games, and I don't know if you've ever seen it, but the protagonist is also a young woman with a PhD in psychology.
It's you.
It's me. And she just wrote a book. It did well. She made a little bit of money. And lo and behold, she meets this con artist. And she knows it's a con artist. And so she thinks she's really in on this. She thinks that she's a very good judge of character. She's a psychologist,
after all.
Yeah,
anyone should get it. It should be her.
Absolutely. And it ends up that she gets scammed, obviously. At the end of this intricate long con, she's emotionally devastated. All of her money is gone. Her bank accounts are empty. And her life is ruined because now she doesn't want to see patients. She just doesn't know what hit her. And I didn't know what hit me after I saw that. I said, oh, my God, is this true? Could this happen to me? I think for everyone, it's kind of this personal thing. You know, uh-huh. Could it happen to me? No, of course it couldn't. And I wanted to figure out, how does it happen that someone who's very smart, who knows human psychology, who should be able to read people's motives quite well, that's her job.
And that ends up being the sort of through line through the book, is you're
exactly.
saying that people who are victims aren't necessarily chumps, but they could actually be just like smart people like you and me. And so why are we so badly equipped to deal with cons? What's going on sort of in our brains that makes us not be able to see through, despite how much we think we know?
Well, I think there are a few things. One of them is that we're trusting by nature. Trust is actually much more evolutionarily advantageous than distrust, because if you trust someone else, then you're able to build a society with them. There's a lot of work that shows that higher levels of generalized trust end up translating to more successful economically societies, to societies with better social infrastructures. And on an individual level, it ends up that trust is correlated with intelligence, with happiness, with well-being. And it makes a lot of sense because social relationships, social networks are incredibly important. And so we can't tell when people are deceiving us, because we're not wired to. It makes it much better and much easier to communicate if we kind of take each other's deceptions in stride.
Okay, so that's the good side of trust. explain the bad side, the confidence game, where that term comes from.
So this term comes from a lovely gentleman from the 1800s who used to approach people on the streets of New York and say, have you confidence in me to lend me your watch until tomorrow? What a bizarre request. And this guy was dressed like a gentleman. You know, he had a top hat, the whole thing. And right away, he builds a rapport, and it's your reputation at stake. Are you the kind of person who trusts in humanity? Do you see the world as a good place? Will your watch be returned to you? Or are you someone who's a Scrooge, uh-huh. who's distrustful of everyone?
Bitter.
Bitter, exactly. Well, what kind of person do you want to see yourself as?
Oh, right, yeah.
So you obviously want to see yourself as a good, trusting, generous person. And so almost everyone agreed and would give him his watch. And when he was finally caught...
How many watches did he have?
I don't know. I wish I did. I'm guessing he had lots.
There's another story that you tell. You actually start the book with con artist Ferdinand Damara. This is a guy who actually passed himself off as a naval surgeon.
He didn't just pass himself off as a naval surgeon. He was appointed by the Canadian Navy during the Korean War as the only doctor aboard a ship heading for North Korea. So here he is in charge of hundreds of lives. And then what does he go on to do? He operates. He actually cuts people open. And this guy never finished high school. He lacks a rudimentary education. We're not talking medical school and that kind of complex knowledge. But what he has is charisma, persuasive powers, and such ego, such egotism to think I can play God, quite literally, right? I'm playing with people's lives.
And was it a disaster? Was his cover blown immediately?
No. He actually was pretty successful because he had learned a few things. First, he did have a wonderful memory and he had a medical textbook. Secondly, before going on this trip, he had conned another doctor into writing a field guide for the troops. So he said, hey, if you're in battle and I'm not there, wouldn't it be a great idea if you had a guide that you could use? And you, darling doctor, you're so much more experienced than I am. You know, wouldn't you love to lend some of that expertise to the troops? And of course, you know, the doctor's like, oh, yeah, well, you know, I am pretty experienced. And flattery gets you everywhere.
Yes.
So this guy writes a field guide that DeMauro obviously was going to be using himself. So armed with a medical textbook, a field guide, and lots of antibiotics, he learned early on that antibiotics are your best friend. He actually performed surgeries. And as far as we know, no one died.
Amazing.
It is pretty amazing. But you know what's even more amazing? The Navy did not press charges after he was caught because they were so embarrassed that they actually let him through their safety net that they just dismissed him quietly and said, please leave. And he did. And he went back to the U.S. and promptly enlisted in the U.S. Navy.
And the cycle started all over again.
And the cycle started all over again. And that's, I think, one of the things that allows con artists to operate for as long as they do. We want to protect our reputations. Almost nobody wants to press charges.
So, I mean, okay, this guy, DeMauro, all the people that you've described so far are obviously very creative, very smart, too.
Yes, incredibly.
Are they psychopaths?
Some of them.
Okay.
Some of them. I think that what I learned was that not everyone who is a con artist is a psychopath, even though that would be so incredibly convenient because then you could say evil person,
yes,
psychopath.
Write them off.
Write them off, exactly. But it turns out that it's much more nuanced than that. A lot of them have the other two of what I call the dark triad of traits.
Let's repeat that, the dark triad
of traits. It's pretty great.
It's awesome. What are the three?
So psychopathy is the first one, and that's a lack of empathy, so you don't experience emotions like other people. So I think DeMauro probably was a psychopath because what kind of person operates on other human beings and thinks that's totally okay? So he probably was a psychopath. He's at the extreme. Then there's narcissism, and that's not just an overblown sense of ego, but it's also a sense of entitlement that comes from it. So
I may not be a surgeon, but I, you know, I'm smart. I deserve to be.
Exactly. So I might not have a PhD, but I'm smarter than everyone with a PhD, so I'm just going to take that PhD because I deserve it.
I'm as good as having a PhD.
Exactly, exactly. So that's the kind of rationalization that goes into narcissism. And then finally, there's Machiavellianism, which is taken from Machiavelli's The Prince. And that's the ability to persuade, to use your powers in order to get people to do your bidding, to kind of bend them to your own will. And if you think about it, most con artists, that's what they do every single day, except we don't really realize it. Just like Machiavelli's ideal prince, nobody realizes that they're bending to his will. They just think that he's a wonderful ruler.
Now, I have to ask, as you were doing research about con artists, did you hang out with some con artists?
I most certainly did.
How'd that go?
Not well.
No. No, what happened?
So they're all really charismatic.
Yeah.
They're all pretty great people. So all the ones I hung out with were male, because most of the ones, I actually didn't have a single female con artist respond to me or approach me, even though females exist. I have a pet theory that women are actually just better con artists, so they're never caught.
Having small children, I think, turns you into a bit of a con artist. So
probably. Well, small children are con artists.
That's true.
So what I found was they're remarkably charming. They're not sleazy. They don't look evil. They're actually really nice. A lot of them had done a lot of background research on me before talking and would say, oh, you know, I really loved your article in The New Yorker about, and they would quote me back to me, and I'd be like, oh, that's so nice. Thank you so much. And all of a sudden, I'm flattered, and I find myself liking
this
person.
But you knew better.
I didn't know better, and yet they're so good at it. And so about halfway, so I worked on this book for about 3 years. About halfway through, I stopped talking to the con artists because I found myself being way too sympathetic to them, because you forget for a moment that this is a person who ruins lives. And that forgetfulness, the fact that happens to me while I know that I'm interviewing a psychopath, imagine how powerful they are.
It's fascinating. I'm Anoush Zomorodi. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. So, Maria, do con artists kind of have to believe their own lies on some level to be effective? Because that's what I can't help but thinking. Like, watching the O.J. Simpson trial, to me, I was thinking, like, he doesn't think that, well, look, the jury's out. Well, what was out on that one? But, like, literally, he doesn't think that he lied. So maybe you don't think you're wrong because you just don't think you are. Like, you think that you're on the right side of this.
Yeah, I think our powers of rationalization are not to be dismissed lightly. And that's just as true of the con artist as it is of the person being conned. And so I think you're absolutely right that a con artist knows what he's doing. I mean, it's very calculated. He's not someone who's has some sort of mental disorder where he can't tell that he's lying. It's not pathological lying. But they do convince themselves that what they're doing is justified. They do go through this process of self-rationalization that makes them, in a way, believe what they do. I think you see this very often with cult leaders who are kind of, I think, the worst of the worst con artists because it's a spiritual con. They take people and they really, it's not money. It's not even a relationship.
No. It's power.
It's power. Mm-hmm. And it's, they really screw with people's minds. I mean, that's your deepest belief about the world. And I think that in order to be effective, they at some point have to drink their own Kool-Aid in order to be able to really, at least at that moment, at the moment when they're saying it, I think they believe it.
Of the victims that you spoke to, was it mostly money that they'd been scammed out of, or was it actually spirituality and other things?
You know, it was a very good mix. So I was surprised. I thought that money would be kind of the primary thing. But the victims who moved me the most were people who didn't lose anything or anything substantial financially. It was much deeper. There were people who were in romance scams. Mm. They were in relationships with people who ended up being completely fictional, who'd created identities, and not just online. One woman that I spoke with, she ended up moving in with a guy who had crafted an entire persona. He did not exist. The person he said he was did not exist. Can you imagine just sharing your life with someone like that and then realizing that your entire relationship was not even built on a lie, that you were dating someone who has exploited you in the most intimate way possible. And other people, there were people who used to be in cults and who felt like the world had just been completely pulled away from them. They didn't know who to trust. Basically, their entire faith in the world was shaken.
So has this book, I have to ask, has it changed the way that you think, the way that you talk to people, the way that you trust people?
Unfortunately, it has.
How could it not, right?
And I went through a time where I just became really cynical, and it was depressing. I actually went through a period where I became quite depressed by the subject because I was focusing now on the victims, and I realized this is really, there are some really terrible people out there, even though their stories are fun and they're so glamorous. And
yes.
You watch Catch Me If You Can and you say, ooh.
Yeah, Frank, I love that movie. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You say, Frank Abagnale, that's so great. Even Damara, the great imposter. I mean, what wonderful escapades. But then you think of the victims and you realize, you know, these people are not very good human beings, and it makes you really cynical. And then I had to take a step back and realize that there's still a tiny percentage of the population, and that most people are not con artists, and most people aren't out to get you. And if you distrust everyone, it's a very cold and meaningless existence, because then you're really unable to form relationships. The only way to do that is if you're just alone in a room.
When we come back, we're going to have more with Maria Konnikova on the psychology of the con. Can we learn to spot a grifter's tricks? This is Science Friday. I'm Manoush Zomorodi, sitting in for Ira Flatto. We're talking this hour about cons and why we fall for them again and again. And my guest is Maria Konnikova. She's author of the new book, The Confidence Game. Okay, so Maria, you talk about the steps that there are when it comes to a con, and that you say the first stage of the con is the put up, and then about halfway through, we get to the rope. Can you sort of explain what happens here?
Absolutely. The put-up is kind of the foundation of the con. It's when the con artist profiles you, so looks at you and says, what are your weaknesses? What are your desires? What are your vulnerabilities? Who are you? But not just who are you, you know, what's your job and are you married, but who are you really? What makes you tick as a human being?
What are you yearning for?
Exactly. Like, it's the kind of psychological analysis that we should really take a moment to do on ourselves, but that we never do.
Yeah, that's true.
And then they have the material that they need to begin selling you whatever they're selling, which is what brings us to the rope. But I want to point out that if you do the put up well, then you can sell anyone anything. I mean, there was a guy, Count Lustig, who sold the Eiffel Tower to Parisian investors not once, but twice.
And he had no claims to the Eiffel Tower whatsoever.
Well, you know, he did have that certificate and it was a war, but he managed to convince them, and it was wartime, that it was going to be used for scrap metal. So you can really read your victims well enough to do something like that. And if you mess that step up, no matter how good you are subsequently, it's not going to work. So the rope is when you actually start putting your powers of persuasion to bear. And one thing that I learned here is that a lot of these techniques are eerily familiar, because they are kind of things that can be used in legitimate persuasion and in legitimate arguments.
Like marketing, or like
marketing.
I don't know, getting somebody to listen to your podcast, things like that.
Or buy your book.
Or buy your book. So where do we draw the line between what is not okay and which is conning someone?
It's a really good question, and one I struggled with, because as I read this, I was like, oh my God, I do this.
Like what? Give me an example. Like,
well, for instance, we talked about the foot in the door technique, and there's another one called the door in the face technique. That's also part of the rope, where you start with a really outlandish demand on someone. For instance, can you volunteer at the zoo with my students for an entire day? And that's a really huge ask,
yeah,
especially if you don't have a prior relationship. And so most people would say, I'm sorry, I can't. And so then, but that's never what you really wanted. So then a few weeks later, you come back and you say, hey, I was just wondering, do you think you might have an hour to write me a letter of recommendation or to do an interview on this topic? And the person says yes, because they feel guilty. Because they've been feeling guilty this whole time that they've
and
said
relative
no.
to a whole day,
it's
I
actually
guess
an
that's
hour.
Nothing.
It's
yeah.
nothing. So all of a sudden, and that's still actually a pretty big demand. And you find time and time again, psychologists love doing these kind of nefarious little studies, that people really do start accepting the second demand much more quickly. And I realized that without realizing and not really doing it on purpose, I've done that in the past.
Yeah. Or if I'm like, eat your whole dinner. You have to eat your whole dinner before you get dessert. No. Okay, then eat just the lettuce.
Exactly. And you always knew that they would not eat their whole dinner, right?
Right, yes.
You wanted them to eat the lettuce. So you start with the big ask, and then the small one seems very reasonable.
It does work.
In comparison, it works incredibly well. It works incredibly well.
Which brings me to another question, though, which is that you write that there's no better mark than one who has already been duped. How is that possible? How can we? I mean, we see what just happened to us. How do you trick someone twice?
Well, because we don't see what just happened to us. We are so incredibly good at wanting to believe that we're not the types of people who could be victims, that when we fall for something like that, we say, it wasn't my fault. It was just bad luck. Luck of the draw. I wasn't conned. It was a bad investment. You know, it could have gone either way, and I just happened to be unlucky. So instead of learning from our mistakes, we rationalize them away. The entire second part of the con, I was shocked to find, is much more self-conning. So you start kind of actively reducing dissonance, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Every single red flag, you say, oh, no, 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 it's not really a red flag. And you kind of dismiss those things so that you still feel like you made the right decision in the first place. And so by the time that you get conned, you're really such a part of the con that you don't want to believe that you've been tricked.
So in our last sort of 30 seconds together, can you just sort of give our listeners something, anything to help them learn to spot them? They know their own weaknesses now, potentially, but just give us a little parting gift, if you would.
Absolutely. I think other than knowing your own weaknesses, you should really learn by heart if it seems too good to be true. It is. It really is. It doesn't matter if it's happening to you, because we can always say when it's happening to someone else, that's too good to be true. When it's happening to us, we deserve it. It's actually
right.
It's just right. So we should just learn that by heart and say there's no such thing as the exception to the rule. And I am not the exception to the rule. It's a rule for a reason.
It's a sad lesson to have to learn.
It is a sad lesson, but it will be a helpful lesson, I hope.
This was so fun. Maria Konnikova is author of the new book, The Confidence Game, Why We Fall For It Every Time. She's also a contributing writer for The New Yorker. Maria, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can read an excerpt from The Confidence Game at our website, sciencefriday.com/confidence game. That's no con. Okay, once upon a time, there was an ordinary incandescent light bulb, like Edison made. It shone brightly, but it wasted a lot of energy put into it as heat. Then came the compact fluorescent. And as costs have dropped in recent years, consumers have increasingly been switching to LED technology for their lighting needs. But in work published this week in the journal Nature Nanotechnology, researchers report that nanophotonic devices may be able to breathe new life into that old school incandescent technology. And joining me now are two of the authors of that study, Marin Soljicic, professor of physics at MIT, and Ogyen Ilik, a postdoctoral student in the physics department there. Welcome to you both. Marin, apologies for not saying your name right.
Hi. No, you said it quite well, actually.
Oh, okay, good. Okay, good. So can you describe how this works? How do you deal with all that lost heat energy that typically escapes from a light bulb?
So as you described, when you heat up a filament in incandescent light bulb, it starts glowing, and a portion, it's actually a fairly small portion, only a few percent, goes into visible light, which is desired. But majority, like 95%, goes into infrared light, which I cannot see, and it therefore presents losses. And in this current work, what we did is implemented this nanophotonic filter, which is placed in front of the filament and lets visible light through, but it reflects infrared light back towards the filament, and so thereby recycling light. And then there it gets absorbed into the filament and hopefully next time emitted into visible light. And this way thereby enhances the overall efficiency of the system.
Huh. And Ogden, how efficient is it, the one that you created?
So it's, to be technical, in our experiment, you know, when we send the same amount of power to the device, we see about 3 times more light in the visible, so to put it.
And so why bother? LEDs are getting cheaper. They're pretty efficient. They're improving a little bit slowly.
Absolutely. LEDs are a great thing, and people should be buying LEDs. People should be working on LEDs. They're actually improving quite rapidly. Our group does work on LEDs. So our work was by no means a motivation to try to displace LEDs or anything like that. The main motivation of our work was to study this principle of recycling light and how well it can be implemented. And we picked this particularly challenging system of incandescent light bulb as a showcase to demonstrate, you know, how well this can be done. And the motivation for studying recycling of light is because that has many potential applications or various different types of energy conversion. So that is really the reason to be doing this, by no means to displace LEDs or anything like that.
We'll get to some of those deeper reasons, but I have to ask you a rather superficial question. We put LED lights on our Christmas tree, and the color was absolutely atrocious. So is light color something that you are looking at, that you could bring back, have the efficiency and the beauty that comes with an incandescent?
Right. So that was the reason why people liked incandescent light bulbs for such a long time, because they had this really nice color. But LEDs are getting rapidly better on that front also.
Okay. Go ahead, Ogun.
As Marian said, yes. So in our case, it's something that in our approach, we could also, based on the application, optimize for color as well. If we wanted to efficiency or color or whatever, because the underlying radiating element has all the richness of the color. So the approach can, in principle, preserve it.
So could you sort of think of this as a filter for light, a filter that only lets through the colors of the light that you want?
Yes, certainly. That is a very good way to think about it.
Okay. So how easy is it to tune these structures to different wavelengths? Could you make a material that works in other parts of the spectrum, Ogun?
That's actually a great point. So we have, you know, especially nowadays, given the nanophotonic techniques that we have, we can really tailor this this concept to a lot of different applications, you know. And in particular, lighting was just something we wanted to do as a little proof of concept. But for other applications, a lot of them energy conversion applications, you would kind of shift these filters to different regions of the spectrum that would give you the best performance.
So tell me about how you actually did this in the lab.
So in the lab, basically, the idea is that this filtering structure is there. They're kind of like a nano-layered cake. So you stack different materials of different optical properties, and their cumulative effect will give you the properties, the optical properties that you want. So it's a combination of, photonic theory, optimization, and in the end, actually fabricating that thing.
I'm Manoush Zomorodi. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. So, Marin, can you just explain, so what other applications are there for this potentially new light bulb? Where can we see this being used, but also what can we learn from it more broadly?
So applications are really for this concept of recycling light. And another one that we are working on has to do with this thing called thermal photovoltaics, which is a way of converting actually heat or thermal energy into electricity. Now, there are many different ways of converting heat into electricity. And this particular one, the way that it works is you get something to pretty high temperature, let's say 1,200 Celsius or so. So it starts glowing. And then you use a photovoltaic. So it's sort of like a solar cell, but not the identical one that you would use, on the roof of your house. You place it in front of this hot object, and then it converts this emitted light into electricity. And as you can see here also, it's desirable that you have certain wavelengths which you can convert well into electricity, and they're desirable, but the ones that you cannot convert, you want to reflect them back so they would be absorbed and hopefully next time emitted in the right wavelength range. So this is just one example of where this concept of recycling light could be beneficial for energy conversion.
And in terms of what you've done so far, you mentioned that you made 6% efficiency. How high could the efficiency potentially get, and what would need to happen for it to really be worthwhile?
So it can go quite high. So really, we showed that, you know, in terms of the photonics theory, we know all the pieces to the puzzle. Now, actually, making something like this in the lab would mean that we have to solve some challenges of fabricating these complicated structures, but also ensuring their mechanical stability, their reliability, and so on. So there's a lot of engineering challenges as well that would have to be solved before we can kind of really fulfill the, so to speak, the potential of this approach.
And Maren, just to sort of sum up for our listeners, why should they be sort of following along with this? Is this just a matter of energy conservation, or because, you know, for a lot of consumers, it was like, oh, I got to switch my light bulbs over. They're more expensive, but I understand that the long-term repercussions will be worthwhile. Can you just sort of make it usable for us?
Yeah, so I think the main point of this is that, you know, as you know, our society faces this huge challenge of global warming and all the energy conversion challenges that come with it. And in order to address this huge challenge, we kind of need to have as many tools in our toolbox to handle it. And you can think of this recycling of light as one more tool, which will then allow us to try to tackle a wide variety of energy conversion problems.
I'd like to thank you both so much for being with me here today. Marin Soljacic, professor of physics at MIT, and Onyan Ilic, a postdoctoral student in the physics department there. Thank you both so, so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of City University of New York. If you missed any part of this program or you'd like to hear it again, subscribe to our podcasts, audio and video, or point your tablet or smartphone to our website at sciencefriday.com, where you can also join our mailing list. If you like us, then like us on Facebook, and continue a week-long discussion on Twitter at SciFry. Plus, how do you preserve thousands of old photos and maps? If you're the New York Public Library, well, you make them easy to access on the web for free. Read all about the movement to make cultural heritage open access at sciencefriday.com/memorybank. I'm Anoush Samarodi, and I am usually over at WNYC Studios, where I host the podcast Note to Self. It is a tech show about being human and maintaining our humanity in the digital age with all the quandaries that we face, whether it's online or with our gadgets, our attention span, and how we make sense of the world around us. Thank you so, so much for having me this week. I appreciate it. And Ira Flatow will be back next week.